David knew that Saul was trying to kill him. And by this point in David's life, he had a lot of personal evidence. Saul had twice tried to run him through with a spear. He had assigned him an impossible battle against the Philistines in which he was more likely to have been killed than not. And Saul had tried to have David seized in the middle of the night, and he only barely escaped with the help of his wife. Jonathan, on the other hand, and maybe this isn't so clear unless we think about it, he didn't know that any of this was happening. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 19, verses 1 through 7, Jonathan had witnessed his father conspiring to do harm to David. But Jonathan, if you recall that part of the story, had confronted his father and thought he had persuaded him not to pursue that goal. As far as Jonathan knew, he had talked him out of it. See, Jonathan had assumed that Saul's anger about David was rooted in a misapprehension. He thought Saul assumed David to be an enemy. And so Jonathan reasoned with his father that David had risked his life on more than one occasion to help Saul and to help the armies of Israel. And he thought Saul agreed with him, and that was that. That was over. So in 1 Samuel 20, when David informed Jonathan that Saul was still conspiring to kill him, Jonathan thought he was lying. We find Jonathan's response to David's accusation in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 2. This is what Jonathan said. He said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. My father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? Never." Jonathan said, "I would know if he was trying to kill you." But David pressed the matter in verse 3. But David also swore, "Your father knows well that you like me, and he thinks, 'Don't let Jonathan know this, or he'll be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death.'" Now, as ancient as this story may be, it's also sadly contemporary. As the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes has written, "What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun." I wouldn't be surprised if each of us listening today had been in a similar circumstance. A friend or an acquaintance makes an accusation about somebody close to us, and we just cannot believe it to be true. Maybe like Jonathan, our first instinct was to deny the accusation, but the person making the claim remained insistent. Well, how then were we to respond? This incident in the lives of David and of Jonathan suggests a number of pertinent and very contemporary questions. And the first that occurs to me, and I've often heard this when people make these sorts of accusations, is the question of gossip. Was David gossiping about Saul by suggesting that he wished to kill him? I've been in many conversations where someone is making an accusation and the others say, no, this is gossip. You have to go to that person directly. We shouldn't be talking about this. Was David supposed to go to Saul directly rather than bringing this information to Jonathan? Was it wrong for David to discuss this behind Saul's back? And that's not always easy to answer. The people preserved in the scriptures are not always presented as pristine examples of godliness. So it's often not easy to determine whether they're being presented to us as good examples or as bad examples. With very few exceptions, most of the people preserved for us in the scriptures have displayed good and bad qualities. David will make some bad decisions later, for certain, that none of us are confused about. So is this conversation between David and Jonathan an admirable one? Is this the right thing to do? Or was it dishonorable? Well, to begin with, and we've been doing this with words throughout our time together, it seems like we often just take our interpretations of words, put them into the scriptures, and act as though we're speaking God's word. But it's very important to do a study of what the Bible means by the words it uses. We've talked about this in terms of the word love, but the word gossip has been similarly mistreated. Some have suggested that any conversation that contains any negative content whatsoever that is had without the accusing or offending party present is what the Bible means by gossip or by slander. But that's not true. That's not what gossip is in the scriptures. There are several words, in fact, in the Bible that are translated gossip. One can be found in Proverbs chapter 11, verse 13, which reads, "A gossip goes about telling secrets, but one who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a confidence." In this context, the word translated gossip is the Hebrew word rakil. It's not on the quiz. I won't have you repeat it. But it's the word rakil, and it refers to a person who shares information that was told to them in confidence. So in this case, gossip is sharing information that one committed to keeping secret. So if someone tells you a secret, you tell somebody else. That's gossip biblically. Another word sometimes translated gossip is the Hebrew word lachash. And it had been translated by the Greek word pisthisthorismus, which is quite a mouthful. It occurs in Ecclesiastes 10:11 and in 2 Corinthians 12:20. In 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul wrote these words, "For I fear that when I come, I may find you not as I wish, and that you may find me not as you wish," which is a veiled threat from Paul. "I fear that there may perhaps be quarreling, jealousy, anger, selfishness, slander, gossip, conceit, and disorder." The word translated gossip here is translated a bit differently in Ecclesiastes 10:11, but it helps you to see the meaning, which reads as follows. "If the snake bites before it is charmed, there's no advantage in a charmer." The word charmed in the Greek translation of Ecclesiastes 10:11 is the word translated gossip in 2 Corinthians 12:20. In the Greek, it refers to whispering that's meant to manipulate. Have you ever had anyone speak kindly to you because they're trying to get something out of you? We used to call it soft soaping when I was a kid, or buttering your bread. That's gossip in the Bible. The Hebrew word it translates, as I said, is lachash, which refers to serpent charming, the whispering or the flute playing or whatever that one does to calm a serpent. And it refers to any type of soothing speech that's meant to maneuver a person into what we want. So that's gossip. So in some texts, gossips refer to betraying confidence, while in others it refers to those who speak kindly or softly, but whose true intent is to manipulate or to deceive. The final word, sometimes translated gossip, is the Hebrew word ragan, which means to murmur or to whisper. And it generally refers to grumbling or complaining that's done in secret. So, for instance, the word is used by Moses in Deuteronomy 1:27 as follows. "You grumbled in your tents and said, 'It's because the Lord hates us that he's brought us out of the land of Egypt to hand us over to the Amorites to destroy us.'" Same word also occurs in Proverbs 18:8, which reads, "The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down into the inner parts of the body." Have you noticed that complaining does that? Somebody's grumbling and you just can't stop listening. The word translated whisperer here is the same as translated grumbled in Deuteronomy 1:27. It's the Hebrew word ragan. So putting all this together, gossip in the scriptures can mean a few things. It can refer to betraying a confidence, or speaking kindly to someone with the intent of manipulating them, or to complaining about someone in private with the intention of feeding a spirit of disloyalty or rebelliousness. So were David and Jonathan gossiping? No. David never agreed first to keep Saul's behavior private, so he's not betraying confidence. David was not speaking kindly to Jonathan in order to manipulate him. I mean, he could have been, but it doesn't look like that's what he's doing. And David was not simply complaining about his situation. David was directly asking for help from Jonathan. So that's not gossip biblically. But is it slander? That's the other one that comes up. There are two word groups translated slander in the New Testament, and they translate a number of different Hebrew words. The two New Testament word groups are related to the words blasphemeo, which we get the word blasphemy from, and kataleleo, which is to speak against. Both have to do with bringing a bad report or making accusations. But in both cases, the assumption in the larger context in which they're used is that these are false accusations or trumped up charges. So if David's accusations against Saul were exaggerated, or if they were false, then yes, David would have been slandering Saul. However, if David's accusations were true, as we know they were, then they were not slanderous. Well, what were they then? What is David doing here? He's not gossiping, he's not slandering. What is he doing? Well, David is actually following the law of Moses. Did you realize that what David has done in this verse is required by the law of Moses? We find the following instruction in Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1. "When any of you sin, in that you have heard a public adjuration to testify. That's a strange translation, but essentially what the Hebrew means is if you have witnessed a sin against the law of Moses and you could testify about it, it's a sin not to. Did you know that? When any of you sin in that you have heard a public adjuration to testify, and though able to testify as one who has seen or learned of the matter, do not speak up. If you don't speak up, you are subject to punishment. This passage in Leviticus informed the people of Israel that it was a sin worthy of punishment to refuse to testify if one had information about someone transgressing the law of Sinai. Saul was attempting to murder David. Murder was prohibited by the... It's in the Ten Commandments. It's one of the first ones. David was required to inform the authorities of what he knew. However, Saul was the authority. So how is David to make that report? Well, Jonathan was Saul's heir, second to the throne. He really is David's only option. So David is not gossiping, and since what he was saying was true, neither was he slandering Saul. Rather than gossiping about Saul or slandering him, David was bringing what the Greek called a kategoria, or the Hebrew a sitna. He was bringing an accusation. David was acting in obedience to the law to inform the next in line to the throne that the king was conspiring to murder, and therefore to break the law of Sinai. So it would seem that David was doing the right thing in his culture by bringing this to Jonathan's attention. But how then was Jonathan to respond? Well, Jonathan too, thank the heavens, was a law-abiding man. If he had not been, it might have gone very differently. And as much as Jonathan may have respected David, and as much as Jonathan may have liked David personally, and as much as David's accusation may have been consistent with the behavior we have seen of Saul previously, Jonathan could not simply take David's word for it. Why? Because of the law of Sinai. The law of Sinai had said the following in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 15 to 19. A single witness shall not suffice to convict a person of any crime or wrongdoing in connection with any offense that may be committed. Only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be sustained. If a malicious witness comes forward to accuse someone of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days, and the judges shall make a thorough inquiry. If the witness is a false witness, having testified falsely against another, hear this, then you shall do to the false witness, just as the false witness had meant to do to the other. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. But David had taken a large risk in accusing Saul of attempted murder. If David's claim was not sustained, then he would have had to receive the punishment that his testimony would have resulted in the one he accused. Once David made the accusation, Jonathan's responsibility became clear. Jonathan could not simply take David's word for it. A single witness was not enough. Jonathan would need corroborating evidence. And so the whole rest of 1 Samuel 20 details Jonathan and David's plan to investigate David's claim so that it could be proven whether what David said was true or false. Consequently, Jonathan became the second witness to his father's intent to murder, and he's not reading between the lines. He got Saul to say it out loud. This is 1 Samuel 20, verses 30 to 33. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he says some unkind things for Mother's Day or for any day. He said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." I don't know Jonathan's mother or why Saul brought her in. But do I not know that you've chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan... he doesn't say at this moment, well, that's enough. I guess we know what Saul wants to do. He still needs to know if there's a ground for that. And so Jonathan answered his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Has he violated the law? But Saul threw his spear at him to strike him. They need to take the spears away from Saul. So Jonathan knew that it was the decision of his father to put David to death. Jonathan becomes the second witness. He knows Saul's guilty. From this point on, Jonathan worked to protect David from his father, which also protected his father in a way in that he never did succeed in murdering David, which would have required the death penalty. The principles surrounding this episode in the lives of David and Jonathan might seem ancient, but do they sound contemporary to you? In fact, these are brought to bear on Christian communities in the New Testament as well. For instance, by the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 19 to 22, we find this instruction. Paul wrote, "Never accept any accusation against an elder, except on the evidence of two or three witnesses." We read that somewhere. "As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest also may stand in fear. In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of the elect angels, I warn you to keep these instructions without prejudice, doing nothing on the basis of partiality. Do not ordain anyone hastily," don't put them in leadership hastily, "and do not participate in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure." So as we find in the example of Jonathan, so Paul has advised Christian communities not to entertain accusations except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. And if the accusation is sustained, to rebuke the offender publicly without respect to their social status or their rank or any other basis for partiality. But wait a second. Didn't Jesus say that if someone sinned against us, we should go to them privately? Isn't this a lot more public than Jesus required? No, it isn't. Jesus' teachings are in line with this instruction of Paul, or maybe better yet, Paul is in line with the teachings of Jesus. In Matthew 18, verses 15 to 17, we find the following teaching of Jesus. "If another member of the church sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. If the member listens to you, you've regained that one. But if you're not listened to, take one or two others along with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If the member refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if the offender refuses to listen even to the church, let such a one be as to you a Gentile and a non-believer." So we should remember this first. Sin is defined by God concretely in the scriptures, not by our own feelings or experiences when someone does or says something. Only God can say when a person has sinned against us. We are not the arbiters of right and wrong. People can hurt us and they can also offend us without sinning. And that's important for us to know. When someone is sinning against us, that is, when someone is acting against us in a way prohibited by the instructions of God and of Jesus, Jesus says we're first to go and point out to that person the way or ways in which they are violating God's instructions. The thought is, maybe they don't realize that this is wrong, so I'm going to show them that it is. That's the first step. No need to do that with Saul. Murder was not a debatable subject in the ancient world. They knew. If the person listens and changes their behavior, then there's no need to go further. Jesus says we're to forgive them 70 times 7 times, right? However, if the person persists in their behavior, we're to bring one or two others along with us. And this is in preparation for an accusation to be made. Because for Jesus, as for the law of Sinai and for Paul, an accusation cannot be sustained except by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If the one or two witnesses also see the same unrepentant behavior and the accused person continues to refuse to repent and change his or her behavior, then the two or three are to bring an accusation, but this time to the larger church body. If the rebuke of the entire community does not lead to a change in behavior, then the person is no longer to be considered a member of the Christian community. Their unrepentant behavior has revealed them to be a non-believer. Well, why? Well, to be a believer, we have all committed to follow Jesus. So no one is rightly to be considered a believer if that person is knowingly and deliberately rebelling against the teachings of God and of Jesus. If Jesus is not Lord, then whatever we are, we're not his. So what does this tell us about God and what it means to follow God's teachings? First, Christians should never consider accusations to be gossip or slander without further inquiry. If someone makes an accusation and comes to one of us for help, that is not gossip and it is not slander. It is absolutely the right thing to do. Now, an accusation could be proven to be slander after an investigation, but it's not to be considered slander without an investigation. The scriptures not only allow for accusations to be made when sins have been committed, the book of Leviticus actually requires those who know about sins having been committed to testify to what they know. That's a big one. Christians could stand to remember that. Many of us know things that would have helped people and we didn't say. Second, false accusations are very serious for God. In the case of the law of Moses, the prohibition against bearing false witness was one of the Ten Commandments. Again, just like murder, don't bear false witness is one of them. And even more, one who falsely accused another was to receive the punishment that their adversary would have received if they had been found guilty. That's big, right? God takes this seriously. In the New Testament, those who falsely accuse others are listed with those who will not inherit the kingdom of heaven and all the lists we're aware of. So Christians should not falsely accuse each other of sin. Third, when an accusation has been sustained by the testimony of two or three witnesses, the findings and the rebuke must be made publicly, not privately. No little documents to say no one will say anything. They should be done publicly. Why? Well, Deuteronomy 19:20 explains it in this way. The rest shall hear and be afraid, and a crime as such as this shall never again be committed among you. And if we thought, well, that's the old covenant, well, Paul said almost the same thing in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 20. He says, as for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. Sounds like the same thing to me. Finally, all of this is dependent on a fundamental conviction that has to be carried by all who follow the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who became flesh in the person of Jesus. God defines sin. Governments have the responsibility of determining what is legal and illegal. That's their purview. We should support them in that. That is what they do. Philosophers explore what is moral and immoral, which is very subjective and can go culture by culture. And each of us personally will decide what hurts us and what affirms us. Nobody can tell us I wasn't hurt by what happened. That's up to me. But for the people of God, only God can define what is sin and what is not. God's instructions about sin and righteousness have been preserved for us in the Christian Bible, maintained by people of faith now for nearly 3,500 years. What God has called sin is sin. What God has called righteous is righteous. You and I do not get to decide if someone sinned against us. Only God can make that decision. May those who have ears to hear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches.